Good morning, everybody, and welcome to the last to know Insights call of the year. I'm not sure anyone could do justice to summing up what a momentous year 2020 has been, so I'm not even going to try. Instead, Katie Ballavy, one of to know Insights team, has put together a short video showing the highlights or lowlights of the year, depending on how you want to look at it. As you'll see, it was so much more than a year of COVID-19, and Joe's going to play the video now. Extraordinary video, and I think it's pretty clear when you look at that that COVID-19 accelerated trends that were already emerging with big advances in the digital economy, the rise of Asia, so many other things. But even if without those COVID-19, I think it would have been an extraordinary year. The Australian and Californian fires and the fact that the Antarctic recorded its highest ever temperatures made clear the world has to return to the point where there's something big is going to be done on climate change. Diversity took centre stage with the tragic killing of George Floyd. And today in the UK, we're facing the prospect of not having an EU trade deal. I could go on. But instead, I'll introduce a group of people who are far more equipped to talk about this than me. Ursula Burns has been a CEO and chair of major international businesses. Still deeply immersed in the business world, she's a senior advisor at Teneo. Philip Aldrich is the economics editor of The Times. He'll be explaining how we're surviving staggering levels of debt that could once have been considered cataclysmic. Amber Rudd is a senior Teneo advisor as well and former Home Secretary. At a time when the UK government has an in-tray overflowing with COVID and Brexit-related matters, she'll be reviewing how they've done. And Wolf Pickerley, the co-president of Teneo Intelligence, will be giving us his take on the global trends of 2020. But before we get to the panel, the usual housekeeping points. Please keep yourself on mute throughout the call. If you drag your cursor to the sidebar of the screen, you can see the chat function. If you want to put some questions in there, please do, and I'll put them to the panel in the second half of the call. And for legal reasons, I have to say, if there are any journalists on this call, apart from Phil, please hang up now. This isn't intended for outside broadcast or publication. Ursula, I'm going to come to you first. This has been a momentous year with COVID, big moves in diversity, inclusivity, and so much more. Can you try to sum up where you think we are as the year closes?
I think that we are in two different states of play, maybe three. On the business side, I think that there is a stunning overperformance of business almost across the board. Let's take out entertainment, travel, and the oil industries, in that they seem to have adjusted fairly well to the conditions of COVID. Many of them are performing at, particularly larger businesses, are performing at the levels of their predictions before COVID. So they've adjusted their supply chains pretty well. Customer buying patterns have adjusted to increase the demand that's out there, And so we're seeing a performance level that is, in some ways, this is a strange thing to say, in a year where oil prices are historically low, where travel is almost to zero, but in many places, the businesses are doing well, doing better than, much better than expected. You can counter that with individuals and smaller businesses that are on the tail end of the supply chain and are struggling. Individuals for sure. The spending capability of particularly the middle class and the poorest people in the world, America is where I'll focus the energies, are being depleted to the point of near crisis. And many of them are living in a very, very iffy situation. So big business doing not so badly in general, and small and mid-sized business and individuals are still trying to figure out a way to have their footing out there. Second on business is that there has been a fundamental change in the responsibility of businesses. It's not clear yet whether that change is a continuous change or if it's just a moment. And that's this recognition that their participation in society has to expand well beyond P&L of their business or the balance sheets of their business. They have to be more responsible, and they are being more responsible in engaging in some of the more vexing social problems that the world has. Racial justice is one, gender equality is another, the environment is a third. So there is a new understanding and I think an adoption and action being taken to include a broader set of stakeholders in the decision-making of business. It's still early days, so I'm not sure it's gonna last forever. I'm not sure if this is a moment or a movement, but I'm hoping it's more of a movement than it is a moment. That there's a broader set of responsibilities, because the third issue that we found in 2020 is that governments across the board are failing citizens in from the perspective of leading them through crisis. They basically are almost across the board, except for probably China, contributing to crisis versus helping individuals adapt and presenting viable solutions. It's definitely clear in the United States. I think it's a little bit less acute, but also clear in the UK. So it's really important that businesses have started to take up this mantra of maybe I should participate more actively and more broadly in defining the kind of future that we want our countries and our communities to have. And then the third and last, and there's many more we could talk about, is this pandemic and how it has kind of accentuated all of these movements. The pandemic has been an interesting and excellent catalyst in one sense of, in one way, and that is to lay bare, to peel the covers off of an underlying set of problems that has existed for a long time, racial justice, the environment, just fundamental inequality of the haves and the haves not have nots. And the pandemic has accentuated that, it's magnified all of that, and it has forced regular citizens, business, and in some cases governments to adjust the way that we interact with each other, to readjust our value propositions to each other. It's still early days to figure out what's going to happen in 2021 and beyond, but I think where we are is we are positioned for, you know, we're at the, you know, at the, you know, tilting point. We can either go really well here, meaning people engage each other and start to define a better future, or just as likely and maybe more likely, we can actually tilt back into our own foxholes, into protectionism, into infighting, this idea that the world is getting smaller and smaller, so I have to grab my piece. It's not clear yet that we're going to, which side we're going to end on. I know that I am pushing for, particularly in the United States, a 1+1=3 solution versus the 1+1=1.5 solution, which our current president, the one that was just lost his election, would have been pushing for. One point I didn't mention, of course, is that we have a new president and a historic statement that a Black woman will be the vice president of the United States, the first woman elected official at this level, either president or vice president. And for it to be a black woman is also kind of momentous, more than kind of momentous, it is momentous. It's not clear to me what it's going to do for policy, but I know it's going to do a lot of spotlight shining on this candidate set.
Ursula, that's plenty to be chewing on. I'm going to come to Phil next. Phil, if somebody told us a year ago that we were going to be facing the economic numbers that we are now, people would have said it was cataclysmic. Do you think there's a false sense of security at the end of 2020, or is the economy actually doing okay?
Well, I mean, clearly the economy is in an appalling space at the moment. I mean, we all know the grim economic numbers as well as we know the health economic numbers, but I think I'll just run through them quickly. We've had a 25% collapse in GDP between February and April. And obviously we've been recovering since, but the latest data, which was out today for the October monthly GDP data for the UK, we're still 7.9% below the pre-pandemic highs. The forecast is, general forecast for the UK are about 11% recession this year. Globally, it's about 4.5%. This is going to be, for us, the worst recession since the Great Frost of 1709, which no one had ever heard of before, but now it's a sort of common parlance, as it were. The contraction in the last 3 months of the year is going to be about 2%. It could be as much as 8% just for November because of the second lockdown. I mean, you go into the borrowing figures and they're frighteningly huge. You've got $394 billion of borrowing this year. That's a peacetime record of 19% of GDP. The national debt above 100% of GDP, that's a 60-year high. And international comparisons for the UK look pretty dreadful. One of the slowest recoveries in the world. The OECD recently produced a report which showed that, you know, of all the major economies, and those include some of the less developed economies, we finish second to bottom in terms of how deep the recession, or how much lost output will still have to be recovered by the end of next year. Only Argentina fares worse. So the UK's picture generally doesn't look good. And of course, the health, what happened in terms of health and deaths per head, we've had a pretty dismal year as well. But this is an extraordinary experience that we're living through. And there are some other numbers to consider here. So you've got £100 billion. That's the excess savings that are estimated households are sitting on. That's involuntary saving that we've been doing because we haven't been able to go out and spend through a couple of lockdowns, general social restrictions, theatres being closed, restaurants at reduced numbers, etc. Another number, £126 billion. That's the ONS estimate of corporate profitability in the third quarter of the year. Corporate profitability in the UK has never been higher than 126 billion. This is a record level. I mean, it's not a figure that you would expect. £30 billion. That's the amount that companies, the Office for Budget Responsibility estimates that companies have saved up by hoarding cash between June and March next year, just over 9 months. This is sort of dry powder, like the household savings, dry powder that can be spent. Then we've got $450 billion of QE just this year that's been pumped into the economy. That's driving, that's a monetary stimulus on top of the £280 billion of government spending. And we've, the amount of stimulus that is expected in 2021, the government will be spending 14.5% more than it was spending in 2019. So we've got enormous fiscal stimulus alongside an enormous monetary stimulus. So, and then we've got another number, which is 90%, and that's the effectiveness rate of all three vaccines. And that's assuming if you take the half dose for the first inoculation of the Oxford vaccine. So the thing about this recession is it's been very peculiar. To qualify as a recession, the downturn has to last for two quarters. What we had was a catastrophe that happened extremely in 2 months, March and April. It just so happens that March is in the first quarter and April is in the second quarter. So technically, we're having a recession. Clearly, on any other metric, it's the deepest recession in 300 years. So that's just the technical aspect. But the point is that the economy is desperately trying to claw its way back ever since. It's not the financial crisis, which was a structural restructuring of the economy. There was structural flaws The permanent damage caused that was uncovered really by the financial crisis and caused in part by the financial crisis as well was about 6 to 7% of GDP. The Bank of England this time reckons that the structural damage is going to be about 1.75%. And the OBR produced its document last week or the week before last. That said, in an upside scenario, this is assuming we get, we get the vaccines rolled out very quickly and confidence recovers very sharply, you could even have no structural damage at all. So you've got this backdrop of absolutely enormous amounts of dry powder in the household savings, enormous amounts of dry powder in the corporate sector, huge fiscal stimulus, huge monetary stimulus, and potentially if the vaccines do their job as well as could possibly be dreamt of, you have you basically have confidence and demand recovering. And people have spoken of the roaring 20s when pent up people stuck at home want to get out, want to spend their money. And so there is a real reason to believe that there is a prospect of something quite a strong recovery next year, but that itself then creates its own problems. Obviously, there's still the risk of a no deal Brexit, and that would that itself will potentially dissipate all of the confidence effects that we're hoping to see in the coming 12 months. All that this sort of roaring 20s idea is more likely to be in the second half of the year if the vaccines come through well. A slow rollout of the vaccines that could also damage confidence. But there are other particular issues, and there are rising fears about inflation hitting at the end of next year. How do you deal with inflation in an environment where the Bank of England would normally have to raise interest rates at some point? Maybe you're looking through to 2022 here, but if the Bank of England started to raise rates, then you start looking at a public debt pile, this 100% of GDP, which starts to become a problematic. And so there are big policy coordination issues between the bank and the Treasury to deal with what could be an overheating economy in 12 months, 18 months time, which seems like a remarkable thing to say when we're literally about to have another quarter of contraction. So, I suppose my general outlook here is that it has been the most remarkable and most dreadful and most devastating year, in my memory. I remember the financial crisis, and that was both exciting and awful. And this has been even more so for obvious reasons. But it is distinctly not the same situation. And we do have this enormous amount of debt that's been taken on to deal with the crisis. But it is there is all this dry powder, and there is genuine prospect of a strong bounce back.
Really interesting. Thank you. Amber, we've been seeing some amazing images of huge things happening, and yet the thing that's on the top of the news agenda again today is Brexit and whether or not we're going to do a deal. Do you think this was the year that the UK government was just completely overloaded, and as a result, loads of things just fell over as a result of it?
Thank you, Craig. I don't think it's just the overloading. I think it's the manner of the UK government and the way it has managed these various crises. I'm sure other people on this call have seen the cover of Time magazine, which is the numbers 2020 in a big red pen through it. 2020 does feel like it's the year that had so many bad things poured into it. But within that, having looked at your video earlier, there are some fantastic things as well. The protein folding, and of course, finishing with the vaccines. And what is so frustrating is the UK is that for the past week, it's felt like the gloom of 2020 has begun to lift with the vaccines, with the prospect of a rollout, which looks like it could be managed much better than some of the challenges we've had this year. And the this small amount, slightly too much sometimes, but small amount of pleasure that the UK people have been able to get in seeing that they are the first country to actually see some people being vaccinated. And that good news has now been snatched away almost overnight, really, by the building up to this crisis dinner last night, with Ursula von der Leyen and Boris Johnson to see if they, as the political leaders trying to achieve a Brexit compromise, could actually reach one. I have for a long time thought that there would be a deal. And because, like many people, I don't really like changing my mind too often, I'm going to hold on to that prospect that there's going to be a deal. Because for any of us, particularly the people I'm sure on this call who think about it, the prospect of no deal, it seems so extraordinary that any government would willingly put their country through such a dangerous and damaging prospect, that I have to believe that Boris Johnson will at some stage compromise in order to avoid that prospect. Everybody knows within the government, the Treasury, advised by the OBR, as well as the cabinet ministers, that even this thin deal is going to be challenging for the economy, for manufacturing. But to get that deal compared to having no deal will make that deal look absolutely brilliant compared to the drama of having no deal at all. So I keep repeating myself, but we are at the moment in the UK at a kind of one of those absolute pinnacle moments where the clock has run down, to use all the cliches, and we're now approaching this crisis again. And quite to answer your question directly, how have we got here? Is it the UK government or is it the challenges it's been thrown? There is something about the UK which has travelled a long way, we like to call British exceptionalism. The amount of times I heard health secretaries, business secretaries, or indeed the Prime Minister this year saying that we are such a great nation, we are going to be better at this. UK is exceeding everybody else. The UK will do this faster and better than everybody else. And yet, actually, as Philip frankly pointed out, we've had some of the worst results this year, some of the highest numbers of deaths and the highest amount of borrowing. And yes, there's always Argentina behind us, but still it's difficult to celebrate that particular ranking at the moment. So I don't think the government has covered itself in glory. And what I am really concerned about now is the fact that adding to the difficulties of COVID, and as we move from the health consequences to the economic consequences, we are potentially going to be hit by no deal Brexit. But if Boris Johnson can do a deal and go into next year, then he has all the good prospects that Philip set out, the savings that are in place, the global economy lifting that will lift the UK. And on top of that, he has the opportunity to actually live the British exceptionalism for a moment and to be at the centre of the big world challenge after COVID, which is addressing dangerous climate change. We have COP26, the gathering of the UN parties in Glasgow, slightly an additional risk I wouldn't have wished on this government, but still, it's in Glasgow next year. But we know how important it is to Joe Biden to address climate change. It's a great opportunity for the UK to really make a closer friend with the US because we are hosting it. So we started 2020 with the drama of the fires in Australia. Climate change continues to rise up the agenda, and with good reason. And when I look back at 5 years ago in Paris, in fact, which opened today, the Conference of the Parties in Paris 5 years ago, which brought together the countries and had the first ever legally binding commitment from them, it is remarkable how much tech and innovation has done to make addressing climate change manageable. 5 years ago in Paris, we were saying, can this be done? Let's try to do it. 5 years on, we're now saying, we can see we can do it. Here are all the tools, offshore wind, solar, new tech, batteries, it's all there. The question is now, when we do it and will we do it in time? But it is fantastic to see how far we've come in 5 years. And the prize is going to be for the UK as well as the world, a successful COP in Glasgow next year.
That's really interesting, throwing it forward. Just to remind everybody, there is the Q&A function on the side of the screen there. Some questions starting to come through, but please put some in. Finally, Wolf, before we get to the Q&A, I'm going to come to you. Very early on, we spotted this idea that COVID was basically accelerating trends that were already happening. Where do you think we are now at the end of 2020, given all of that?
Sure. I think there are 2.5 stories to tell there. First, the role of the state. Second, we already heard more about the UK, but it's a global story, it's debt. And third is fiscal policy. Let me start with the state. The state is a big winner here out of the pandemic. The state has become stronger over the last 10 years across the board. I'm talking about globally here. The pandemic was a big accelerator. And this, especially I refer to the role of the state in the economy. Now, as of now, there are 110 countries that have adopted industrial development strategies. So, you know, industrial policies are back in fashion there. We have looked at the state to deal with the pandemic, save lives, to save businesses, to save economies. Now we're looking at the state to provide the vaccines. So the question for me is, will the state return the power that it acquired? Will the state reduce its role in the economy in the future, or will it keep it there? Also think about the role of the state in controlling our individual freedoms and so on. And when we look around right now, there is a huge emphasis, and this is somewhat related to what Ursula was mentioning earlier, about reliance across the board. The Chinese, they provided almost $3 billion for Chinese for Japanese companies to reshore business. China, the five-year national plan, if we look at that on the technology front, is all about acquiring self-sufficiency in the competition against the United States. Even Europe is talking about strategic autonomy, where they're planning to use competitive policies, competition policy, trade policies to increase the competitiveness of the biggest trading bloc in the world. In emerging market, Modi talks about India that is basically reliant on itself. So the risk here is that, yes, there is a prospect of an economic recovery, but an recovery that could be somewhat affected by the stronger role of the state in the economy. So industrial policies, the level playing field being affected, more control on FDI, and so on. So that is one key area here. And it applies to the emerging market and developed economies across the board. Even Biden, huge emphasis on made in the US, especially in terms of technology, 5G, manufacturing, and so on. The other story, which I think is again related to politics next year, is about fiscal policy. Because this year, lots of the heavy lifting has been done by the central banks. But that is not working. I mean, it's clearly is not no longer suitable. I was looking this morning at, there is an analysis by the European Union about loss of income during the pandemic crisis. And obviously, the most affected are the low pay employees, women, and the youth. Well, monetary policy cannot do anything about that. So it's a time for fiscal policy. So we're going to see more fiscal policy next year. The issue with fiscal policy that is inherently political is much more opaque, less transparent than monetary policy. And thirdly, it requires state capacity to actually implement it. So we're going to see, you know, a very mixed picture there on the fiscal side. But when we talk about fiscal policy, we have to talk about taxation, because it's not just about spreading money, but it's also raising revenue. So the debate on taxation here is going to come back on the agenda, because as we've already discussed, there is no money left in the kitty across the board. And taxation, for example, could be one major friction point between Europe and Biden, the new US administration, in terms of taxation of digital companies, big businesses, and so on. So fiscal policy at large is going to become much more salient than we have seen so far in 2020. Finally, in terms of debt, we have heard the story in the UK. Well, it's not much better elsewhere, if it makes anybody feeling better. Global debt to GDP will increase from 320% to 365% in 1 year. We had already plenty of emerging market and frontier economies with lots of debt accumulated before the pandemic. Argentina was already in trouble before the pandemic. Zambia was. Mozambique has already defaulted before the pandemic. This year alone, emerging market, they have $4 trillion of debt that is maturing. There are already six or seven sub-Saharan Africa, African countries in distress. Argentina, Ecuador, and the list will go on. Meanwhile, politically, the idea of providing debt relief is not really flying. Let's see whether with Biden coming, this will become take on a bit more. But so far, we haven't seen much. And big role there is China, because China has become a major provider of financial help, especially to frontier markets, emerging markets. And so far, the Chinese have not been very forthcoming in terms of providing some sort of moratorium on debt. So debt is going to be another big story. The faster the economy recover, which we all want, the faster this debate on debt will come on the agenda at the end of the day. And what we have seen here, that every single time there was a huge accumulation of debt, we had a crisis. Latin America in the 80s, Asia in the late 90s, the US in 2000. So the good things here is that it's going to be household debt is much lower than in the past. The banking sector is generally in a better shape than it was 10, 15 years ago. But corporate debt is much higher. And we have never went through a crisis where corporate debt was the biggest story. So we don't have a necessary a template we can use to deal with that. Final point, I think, on the climate. The question will be, in my view, whether we have a dirty recovery or a green-led recovery. All the signals is that green is fashionable. Money has been put on the table. I mean, Biden talked about $2 trillion. It's not going to be $2 trillion. But Biden, without the control of the Senate, the environmental policy of Biden will not take off without the control of the Senate. It will struggle. And the issue there is not just for the U.S., because without U.S. leadership at home, we are not going to get U.S. leadership globally in terms on the environmental front. In Europe, I think 2021 will be a big year for climate. Plenty of money has been allocated to that. And it's a big year for business as well, because lots of the carbon emission trading schemes and so on will have to be revised. And that will bite for certain kind of businesses. So it's a very mixed picture there on what we're going to see on the climate front. Let me stop it there and thank you again.
Okay, thanks, Wolf. Look, there's a huge amount to talk about in the next half hour there, but two big things really jump out at me from that conversation. One was the point that Philip was making about corporate profitability and what that means in terms of purpose and responsibility going forward. And then the other thing was the purpose of the state. So Ursula and Philip, let's take on corporate profitability and what it means. Is there a sense in which Ursula, like big business, actually would quite like things to stay in the way they are in terms of how people are staying at home, not using offices, that kind of thing? Or do you think he does want to race back to normal quickly?
I think that there is definitely a desire, and the question is whether it can work itself out, for things to stay the way they are now. What do I mean by that? That is, companies have been able to take advantage of this slow down to lean out a bit, to kind of under the veil, lighten their load, cutting pay, reducing number of employees, reducing sites, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. They've done that under the umbrella of, you know, obviously the government says you can't do it, so we won't do it. I don't believe that there will be a large ratchet back to the way things were. I think that we will continue to, businesses will pocket for future investments, for future down, protect them themselves for future downside risk. They'll continue to pull back or to be pulled back until, particularly in 2021, till they kind of see how the economy starts to recover, how their business lines start to recover. Until that happens, I don't believe that there will be a snapback in spending and engagement by business. I do agree. I think it was Wolf or Philip who said that. I think that there will be a pretty aggressive snapback by individuals. I think it's a little bit more emotionally driven than it is practically driven from an individual perspective. We're seeing it already. Every time there's an opening up, there's a lockdown or a slowdown. Every time there's an opening up, I live in both US and in London. It's amazing what happens with this little window of like kind of blue sky, people kind of rush out and start to participate again. So I think that from a personal perspective, we'll see some of that. But on all of the boards I'm on, no one is lining up to actually start spending again as soon as they have a chance to do that. they're settling in and they're going to take stock in what's happening in the future. In the United States, one of the big drivers is going to be tax policy. It's still a real question, and a lot depends on what happens in Georgia, right? So Will said it. If it turns out that the Democrats get control, then I think that we will see tax policy that, I mean, I think we know that we'll see tax policy that is not in the short term favorable to business or to wealthy individuals. And if they don't get control, then I think that we'll see a more status quo of where we are today, with some tinkling of this policy on the edges, but not a wholesale change. And that is one of the things that's businesses are going to wait on to see how that's going to be flushed out. We'll know on January, 4th, what happens. But even after that, we're going to have to figure out what stance the Biden administration is going to take on trade and on taxation and on immigration. These are three areas that will drive the economy. And I think it's too early to tell there. But I think because it's too early to tell, people are building plans that are a lot more conservative than we would like.
Right. And Philip, you raised this issue of corporate profitability.
Yeah.
How do you think that unwinds? I mean, one of the questions here from Alice Hunt is about, you know, whether or not there's going to be a windfall tax or something like that. I mean, how do you see that unwinding?
Well, first of all, I'd just say Ursula's absolutely right. It's the, it would be the households that will spend initially. And the question is whether there's enough household spending and enough household confidence that then the businesses come in behind that and then start investing with their dry powder and start to see the potential for revenue and sales and profits or whatever. So then they will invest behind the households. And obviously there will be a lot more caution until you see what the households are doing. And then that's obviously going to depend on the vaccine rollout and whether the confidence comes back sufficiently. So, you know, you've got these kind of sequence, everything needs to fire in sequence in a sort of perfect order. The thing is, obviously, for every business is also we've got this K-shaped recovery, as people say. Some households are doing really well, other households are doing dreadfully. Some businesses, some industries are doing really well, like the tech sector and the supermarkets, and some industries are having the most dreadful time. High street retail, hospitality, theatres, etc. It depends, which sector you're in. I see, one of the things I see is this commercial property. Like, people are not going to go back to the office in the same numbers as they were. And anecdotally, I'm hearing, quite a bit that, rents are having to come down. There's going to be a change in our city, urban sort of, just the way we use urban and city space. And as a result, the big commercial developers are going to be worried about their prospects. All the sort of ancillary services that feed into the sort of lunchtime or the office district. We've seen a couple of big restaurants in London yesterday have shut their doors. There's going to be, companies are going to have to make their decisions based on the particular experiences that they're having. But the bigger picture is whether corporates kind of bring in the investment, because the aggregate level of spending potential is there. And then what, as Ursula says on tax, just finally quickly, that the government is going to, it must at least consider some kind of pandemic levy, some kind of solidarity tax. We've seen it in Japan after the Tohoku earthquake, we saw it in Germany after the reunification, and we did it in the UK. We had excess profits levies after both the First World War and the Second World War. So it's not unknown to have some kind of solidarity tax, as you might call it, and companies would be expected to bear some of that potentially.
Okay, let's take on the other big theme, which is like the role of the state. I mean, the state is back in the way that in developed Western economies it just wasn't for the last generation. Amber and Wolf, I'll start with you, Amber. Is the state actually equipped to take the sort of weight that is being expected of it? Let's start with that point.
I mean, the evidence would suggest not, I'm afraid. And really, let's not forget this is a conservative government. The whole conservative mantra is about keeping the state under control and about critiquing the state as not being an efficient spender of people's money in the way that people should be able to spend their own money and keeping that tax burden low as a result. Now, everything has changed as a result of this year, but at the core of it, Conservatives do not expect to be a party in government that is interventionist, which it's become this year, and tax rising. Now, of course, there are exceptions to that, and Philip has set out some of them. And I would add to that when George Osborne did the excess profit tax on the oil and gas industry in the North Sea, which was not at all popular, and it did not help him much, although it did raise some money. So I think it's going to be another battle for next year. I think that Rishi Sunak and the Chancellor's interests are going to be to raise taxes. He's caught by the fact that Boris Johnson, the Prime Minister, is very against tax raising, but embraces spending. So at some stage, the UK government is going to have to try and reconcile these things. And I would not be surprised if they did go for some sort of one-off move, like Philip has suggested, because there's something in a one-off move which allows them to say, we are still maintaining our position as a government that wants to reduce taxes and reduce the state, but just one-off doesn't change the actual character of us as a government, but is necessary under these circumstances.
Wolf, you sort of alluded to this a bit. If you look east, actually, the state, where the role of the individual is not considered so important, they're perceived to have done it very well in terms of coronavirus. Do you think that's created pressure on the West?
Well, there is already debate whether Asia is not just the future economically, but also in terms of the shape of the state. So is China, is Taiwan, is South Korea, is Singapore, where you have seen strong state, a very capable technocratically driven, technology-driven bureaucracy, together with a sense of collective responsibility, which I don't think we have in anywhere in the West. And certainly less sensitivity towards issues like individual freedoms, data privacy, and so on. That is what has kind of emerged there. Can we adopt that? Can we look at it? I think we will see debate there, but I think it will be this kind of formula, transferring this formula from one continent to the other. I think it would be a challenging one. One thing that is also interesting about the state, especially in Europe and especially in this country, but not only, it applies to Spain, Italy, is the relationship between the state and the devolved administration, which has really been put under pressure by the pandemic. In Spain, it was a disaster between Madrid and the regional autonomies. In Italy, with the 21 region fighting every other day on the restriction, on money, who to blame for how the pandemic has been badly managed. And here in the UK, you know the better the story than I do. So that is another interesting debate here, how the relationship between the center and the periphery will evolve in the future, especially in an environment where you might have scarcity of financial resources to try to keep everybody happy.
Okay, let's move on to climate change, because I think looking at that video, 2020 was a year of extraordinary developments in terms of climate change. It's those fires pictures in California and in Australia. We had the hottest temperatures in Antarctica. And we also saw big moves from government in terms of saying what they were going to do right the way around the world. Ursula, how significant is Joe Biden becoming president in this? And do you think he really is going to lead the world, do a lot more on climate change? Or do you think that's just something that's an aspiration?
Oh, I don't think it's an aspiration at all. I would argue whether he's going to lead the world. I would say he's going to fundamentally change the stance of America on this subject, no doubt. He and his vice president have run on a platform, many platforms, but one of the platforms is that we can no longer ignore facts about, or perceived facts about what's happening out in the environment, and that they are going to have to do something about it. John Kerry's appointment as the climate czar sounds a little bit funny, but it's not. It's a serious role that is meant to re-engage the United States in the conversations that are happening around the world. As you know, we've pulled away from every conversation about anything meaningful, not only climate, but to re-engage the United States in those conversations and to start a set of conversations between the government and educational institutions and oil and gas and new energy institutions inside the United States to actually figure out a way to be more assertive, more affirmative in dealing with a problem that for most most people in around the world is fairly obvious. But in America, at least, we've gotten into this debate about whether or not it actually is happening. As we see stuff burning and temperatures rising, there's still a debate about whether or not this is really a fact or some kind of a fiction. So I think that what we'll see from the United States, it may be a fumble, but it'll be movement. It may be a fumble, but we're going to see movement. And hopefully that movement is a movement, I think it will be, movement that is inclusive of other powerful nations around the world to learn from and to become re-engaged. I don't believe that there's any risk that we're going to sit on the sidelines on this subject. The fundamental question is going to be whether or not it's right, whether or not we're doing the right things.
So, Philip, we just one phrase that we just keep hearing towards the end of 2020 is the green economy. And we keep hearing about, you know, hydrogen and that kind of thing, but we actually can't produce nearly enough hydrogen at the moment. We hear a lot about green infrastructure investments, but we know how long it takes to get these projects off the ground, that kind of thing. Are you buying all the discussion about the green economy and that's the way it's going to go? You raised the prospect of dirty versus green. Do you think it really is going to be something that we're going to see moving forward properly?
I mean, obviously there's enormous commitment to spend on the green economy. My big question, in fact, I'd love Amber's thoughts on this actually, is whether the government will have the balls to go with a carbon tax, because really if we're going to deliver Paris Accord, you know, levels of emission reduction, we're going to have to change the price of carbon because we have to reset the incentives. And the most effective way of doing that is going to be surely a carbon tax, which also brings in revenue for governments at a time when they desperately need that revenue. It'll be enormously unpopular in a country where we haven't even been able to raise fuel duty since 2010. But it just strikes me that, the really big step, obviously the government can spend a lot of money on, you know, these blue sky thinking ideas about hydrogen, which, you know, are not going to deliver in the short term. It can spend money on more effective policies like insulating homes. But the real big game changer, I think, is going to be things like repricing carbon and carbon taxes.
By the way, I agree with you, Philip. I'm unfortunately an energy company board wonk. I'm on the board of ExxonMobil, and I agree that without a real clear discussion and some agreement on changing the economics of carbon versus the other fuels in the most effective way and straightforward way is a carbon tax, we are going to continue to be debating, I think, a stupid, you know, kind of having a silly debate. So sorry for interrupting.
You didn't answer the carbon tax point, but also it seems blindingly obvious, and you've made this case time after time, that the government really does need to grip hold of this with COP26 in the UK at the end of next year, needing to do a huge amount of infrastructure investment. Recently, it feels like they don't have a tight grip on this. And Rishi Sunak's spending statement, that kind of thing, they haven't really made this front and centre.
Fantastic opportunity for the UK government to change the subject on Brexit, on COVID, on economy, and say, look, we can lead on climate change. We've got COP26, and we can do this in sort of in partnership in a way with the US. So I can only justify the fact that Boris Johnson himself hasn't made any important speeches on it, and Rishi hasn't spoken about it in his spending review, on the fact that they are dealing with the crisis in hand, of which there are plenty, just starting with COVID and Brexit. But it is so obvious that they need to seize this leadership opportunity next year that I think we'll see a lot coming out next year. And by the way, this weekend too, the UK government's trying to make a big drama out of the anniversary of Paris 5 years ago with its UK Climate Ambition Summit. Just on a carbon tax, I mean, Obama was asking for that many years ago. It is the obvious solution, but it does require the sort of integration that hasn't been achievable. But one of the requests of Paris 5 years ago was to improve some sort of trading system, call it a carbon tax, a border carbon tax, some sort of trading in carbon so that there is a price on carbon. And of course, the EU has one with the ETS. It needs tightening, but the EU has already said that it's considering a carbon border tax, which would be a very effective way of putting a price of carbon on goods and stopping people saying, which I used to get the whole time in Parliament, people like John Redwood would say to me, what is the point of all this when China are just manufacturing the goods and basically ignoring and using huge amounts of carbon to do so? And there is quite a lot of evidence that shows that the EU and the UK, call them two now, have in fact been exporting our carbon emissions by allowing that to happen. So I would really welcome some sort of border carbon tariff, which the EU are considering. And I think the UK has yet, Philip, to answer that question. They've said very vaguely they are likely to participate in the ETS and some sort of version should the EU come up with it. But we haven't seen what yet. But it is the least harmful way to deliver on the necessary carbon reductions. And in a way, the public, I feel, would like that to happen, so the decisions taken away from them. I do think, if I may just add, that Joe Biden's election is hugely significant for addressing climate change. The fact that he's already said they're going back into the Paris Agreement is fantastic. So I think we can all welcome that for that reason alone. But the other thing I would add is right at the start of this year, BlackRock announced their requirements for investment and seeing that companies were going to be having their own program for addressing climate change. And I think that that's hugely significant too. The investment community are moving towards those demands. That's going to be about following the money as well as doing the right thing.
Yeah, so Wolf, China, that's the big point that was being alluded to. China and India are like 2/7 of the world's population. If America, Britain, the EU, Australia are all prepared to do more on climate change, can we actually expect India and China to do it as well?
Well, the Chinese have now are committed to carbon neutrality by 2060. The European is 2050. We haven't heard much from India. So I think the Chinese move, actually, if it is interesting, one dimension is about the potential pressure they will put on countries, on other emerging markets like India, basically. So that is one part. But I think, going back to the point I made earlier, I think without US leadership on this front, and for that, I think Biden, first of all, needs to deliver at home to claim some sort of lead, because rejoining Paris is very easy. It takes 1 month notice. So by the 20th of February, the US could be back. The question whether they can deliver, because without the US leadership, it would be difficult to push ahead, specifically in emerging market and so on. I think there is also one other dimension to discuss here, because it's all very good to talk about climate, but for business, I was looking there now, there are more than 2000 pieces of different legislation about environmental standards globally. 10 years ago, there was only 200. So for businesses, the reality here is that we might end up with a patchwork of different environmental standards that complicate cross-border operations, supply chains, and so on. So there is a cost attached to this. Let's be very clear. On the other way around, like Amber just underlined, climate reputation will become also, is not just a downside risk for companies, but also is an opportunity, as long as you are able to play that in a good way.
Okay, so we're coming towards the end of the call now, and we were very much trying to review 2020. So I just want to ask each of you the same question in turn. Do we think we'll look back on 2020 as that time front cover with a big X through it, or are actually there quite a few reasons for optimism that in time we will maybe see outweigh all the negatives there's been? So Ursula, let's start with you on that.
I think that we'll look back on 2020 with a positive, with a positive set of thoughts about it. Primarily because I think the status quo was unsustainable. And while it seemed comfortable because we kind of got used to it, we kind of know how to operate in it, in this logjam around major problems, this idea that that diversity, equity, and inclusion is just going to, you know, we'll deal with that later. This idea that the environment, you know, we can just kind of hold our breath, maybe things will get better. This idea that there's this massive gap between the poorest and the richest, or the average and the richest, or the above average and the richest. All of these things became, you know, so on the top of everybody's discussion topics that unless we are, you know, a bunch of stupid humans, which I don't believe that we are now faced with a set of problems that we should probably, and I think people are ready, regular humans are ready, not government only, to do something about it. So I think that 2020, I say this a lot, George Floyd, you could say that George Floyd died for nothing. He was killed for nothing. And I think the other way to think about this is that George Floyd's killing was the price that unfortunately America had to pay to get off its butt and start American business to get off its butt and start thinking about what the heck we're going to really do here versus saying the government's going to take care of this. So I think that on all of these, the fires in California and Australia, this pandemic, we're going to look back and say, things weren't that great. We kind of got used to them. Maybe this is the time that we can attack these problems in a more adult and systematic and inclusive way. I'm hoping that that's the outcome. So I'm looking forward to 2021 and beyond.
Philip.
I think we will look back and we'll remember this year, obviously, for all the horrors of it. But one of the aspects is, you know, the policy response has been as absolutely remarkable. You know, the way that governments have been able to step in, the way that pharmaceutical companies have been able to produce a vaccine in 1/10 the time that it would normally take, the fact that, you know, so much can be achieved in such a small amount of time is one of those lessons from this crisis that if it doesn't linger, people will look back on this year and think, why couldn't we be like that more often? And then at the same time as that, we've seen these, and a lot of this comes back to the digital economy as well, but we've seen remarkable advances there, like the protein folding stuff in the video at the start. And there's in Oxford, they're close to developing a vaccine for malaria, you know, which is, you know, again, would be an absolute game changer. And monetary policy has been remarkable. The amount of QE that's been done, how it's been propping up government debt, this interaction between the sort of the policy levers that we have and how powerful they can be is a lesson that I think will not be forgotten.
Amber, a couple of sentences from you.
I think it will depend on how we respond to these huge questions that have come out of 2020, as set out by Ursula and Philip. But mostly, I think that we will want to forget 2020 as the year where so many people have had such a difficult year. But it does finish the most extraordinary discovery of the vaccine. And we just need to remember that it wasn't obvious when the COVID virus first hit us that a vaccine would be found at all. And it is remarkable and something to celebrate that there is going to be one. There is one in place, and hopefully it'll be available for us all soon.
Wolf, a brief word from you.
I think it's been an extraordinary story of human resilience. Remember, a few months ago, people were concerned about social unrest and so on. We haven't seen much at all caused by the pandemic. So I think the ability of humans to adapt to the new reality is something to stress. Whether we're going to be more divided or more united on all sorts of issues that we discussed so far, I think is still a huge question mark, especially on the socioeconomic front. My concern is that the issue we had before, inequality and so on, the role of women in business, the youth, what is the future for young people on the employment front, that I'm not particularly optimistic.
Thank you. I found that fascinating. I think, you know, there's so much there. We could be talking for days about all of this. But I'd like to say to everybody, if we could give our usual virtual round of applause and standing ovation to a great panel, Philip Aldrich, Amber Rudd, Ursula Burns and Wolf Pickley, you're all great. We're going to give you a break from all these serious discussions until January, when we're going to come back with a panel that is going to include Zanny Minton-Beddoes, who is the editor of The Economist, and William Hague. So all that's left for me to say is have a very good festive period and bye-bye to 2020. Thanks very much.